I sometimes feel about this community like I feel about finding a really great climbing site or a really great mountain bike ride, especially in parts of the world where those things are sometimes hard to find. I kind of have this experience like I want to share this, but I don't really want to see it get cluttered up with people who don't get how precious it is. I don't know if you ever find yourself in a space like that. When I stand back from that feeling, though, it's a little bit conflicted, right? It feels like it's pretty understandable to want to protect something that feels precious to me, whatever that is. And there seems to be something in me, at least, I hope in us, because I'd love to not be the only one struggling with this, but in me, at least, there's this kind of this default setting that says that if I want to protect something precious, the best way to do that is to keep it a secret, right? Like to or at least be really selective about who I tell, and that's the best thing I could do. But percolating along underneath that, it seems like there may very well be some assumptions that aren't especially healthy or especially kind and good. For instance, when I stand back from this a little bit, I start to wonder, who am I to think that I know who will or won't handle with care what I cherish? Do I have a contribution to make to that assessment? Absolutely. If I don't, I'm powerless in this equation. So that doesn't work either. Am I the last word in this? Do I see it all so that I can make a final judgment? That's not a good way to think about it either. So there's that little complexity. And why is it that I think that isolating or making an in-group around something is the best way to keep a beautiful thing intact? What if what makes something lovely is actually the act of sharing it with somebody else? What if that's part of the beauty of it? And I do mean sharing it, and not insisting that someone else like what I like or cherish what I cherish, but just offering it with an open hand to see who resonates with the offering, right? Which is a different thing. So I've been reflecting on some of these questions this past week, and partly I've been doing that as part of doing some thinking and writing that I hope will help other folks join us in this community's exploration of belief. So for instance, I'm drafting a frequently asked questions page for our website, which will eventually pop up there, sort of an attempt to help people find their way through their own set of standard entry-level questions about what's the nature of this community, because our website doesn't really provide standard church answers for some of those standard, I'm looking for a church questions. You can't find a statement of belief. You can't find a strategy. You can't, like, there's just these things, and it's not because we hid them. It's because we don't have them. And so that's, people just run into that. I get the emails. You can find me. We're not unfindable. I can get an email from somebody, and they're like, so what do you guys actually believe? Anyway, I thought there might be some ways to sort of speak to those questions to help folks get a better preemptive grip on what sort of community this is and what its emphases might be. So as part of that writing, I've started to realize that some of my own inclination toward protectionism, which is the word I'm going to use for what I was just trying to describe, that some of my inclination toward that has some pretty deep religious roots. Religion, in particular the Christian religion, has had a pretty rough ride in the news the last few weeks. If you're a Catholic or a recovering Catholic or a ex-Catholic, can you be an ex-Catholic? Anyway, if you're a Catholic, your whole denomination is on the ropes at the moment, like right up to the Pope. And if you're a Protestant, particularly of the evangelical stripe, then some of your local leadership is in the news in a way that stirs up all sorts of strong feelings that range from outrage to disillusionment to the just deepest kind of unsettling sorrow. And some of the international heroes of that movement are not really faring a lot better the last few weeks in the news. And it might beg the question, like, who wants to protect that? Why would anyone think that other people might find that, as it shows up in the media, intriguing or winsome or in any way related to the longings of their heart and their life? I sometimes feel like I'm reluctant to tell people what I do, just because I don't want to be associated with the scandals, I don't want to be associated with the most commonly broadcast perspectives on what Christian means. And I wonder if it might be a little bit like having a family member that gets themselves in trouble with the law. That's my sibling, but I'm not like them. I don't do X, Y, or Z. You can trust me. I wouldn't leave your car unlocked when they're around, but you can trust me. And for me, anyway, I started to feel like I began to have some empathy for Peter, in this moment in the Jesus story where Jesus is being accused of all sorts of insurrectionist charges. And by the way, those charges in context are just as serious as anything in the news cycle that's being leveled at religious leaders. And someone recognizes Peter as the friend of the accused and suggests that that might be the case, and his prompt response is to disassociate himself vigorously and, I would say, disingenuously, saying of his friend and his mentor, "I never knew that guy. I never knew that man." I think our age gives us access to some very easy to engage research on why we do this. I mean, pick up anything by shame researcher Brené Brown. Like, we're great at the shame game, but we're not really great at owning it, right? So why would we want to show up for anything recognizably religious under those circumstances? Never mind inviting somebody else to join us, right? And I think that to dig a little deeper into that question, I need to unpack some of the assumptions that might go with it. Now, the particular assumptions that I want to open this morning are my own. They might not be the ones you were handed, but they are what come to the surface when I think about what I grew up with, and particularly when I think of, when I ponder why it is that I'm inclined to behave as though my experience of spiritual community isn't something that I just can't wait to share with others. There's lots of places we could take this, but to focus where I want to take it, I want to play you a song.
Tell me it's some kind of zombie.
It's not some kind of zombie, I'm sorry. I'm not taking this to the zombie place. For those of you that are zombie fans, I apologize for even titillating that in the blurb. This is from an album that was played a lot in the dorm rooms of the private Christian schools I was attending when I was growing up. So, yeah, this is an old song. And in fact, it's kind of hilariously dated, especially as we're going to see it. If you're joining us by podcast, you need to know that we're about to watch a lyric video of a song called "I'm Gonna Live" by a band called Servant. I can't include it in the podcast, but it's easy to find on YouTube. So if you really want to have the full experience of this, if you're joining us by podcast, you should go look up the song. All right, here we go. We're going to watch the whole darn thing.
That's
terrible. Anybody miss the theme for that particular? Okay, so admit it.
I'm a dead man anyway.
Admit it. You want that hair. You want those clothes. The golden age of rock and roll is in the past. Right? Was that not just epic? Oh, man.
Terrible. They're very flexible, too.
Hey?
They're very flexible.
Yes, yes. One of the reasons we had to watch the whole song is because you have to be 3/4 of the way through before you see that flying split leap thing that's just like a signature. Well, I didn't put you through that just because. That song is, and it didn't put us through the second half. I heard the, oh God, no moment go through us when you wiggled the mouse and we saw that it was only half done. Somebody actually said it's only half over. Because the number of choruses at the end is an important part of the shape of the song. It's an important part of the shape of the ideology that drives the song. This is one of the song. This song, and the reason I made us listen to the whole thing, I want you to know you're always free to leave the room. That's part of the culture of the table, right? But one of the reasons that I was insistent about it is because this is one of the most concise summaries of the worldview that I grew up with that I can think of. And it offers, I hope, the possibility of some insight into a couple of really big trouble spots when it comes to why religion and those within it might sometimes do quite awful things and then wonder why everyone seems so upset when they try to tidy it up. And I know we just had one song pass at the song, but let me just ask you this. What does the songwriter think of or imagine as their home address? Where are they from?
Somewhere else.
Yeah. Somewhere else. Not here, right? if we think about that in terms of what they're working to build up or to make better or to prepare themselves or others for, what is that? Like, where is that? Wherever it is that they belong, it's not here. Here is not what they are working to make better. I don't really think there's another way to understand a lyric like, my home is not down here, my home is far away. Like, and just in case we thought they were talking about the burbs, you know, like, here's part B. I heard about the streets of gold, the mansions in the sky, no more sorrow, no more pain, no more will I cry. There will be no sun or moon, for God shall be our light, because I'm going home to heaven, and death too is life. Do you ever wonder why, as a collective, Christians that make such a big deal out of the earth being made by God aren't also on the leading edge of helping us all respond constructively to runaway climate change? Do you ever wonder about that disconnect? Do you ever wonder why the Christian right provides such a comfy home for climate change deniers? It's all right here in this little rock and roll gem. It's because of this particular thought that there might someday be no sun or moon because we set the whole damn place on fire in a way that we can't put out. That's actually not that distressing if you think that this earth or this solar system or this universe is not your home. It's just like some kind of a place where we hang out for a little while we're on our way to reality. The song actually tells that part of the story. It actually talks about the implications of this. I'm quite confident this is not the way the songwriter's thinking about it, but it's in the song. Oh, I gave them all the cash I had and turned and walked away. They got what they were looking for. And a whole lot more that day. Questions that come to mind. Did they really get what they were looking for that day? And does the songwriter imagine that they'd give a rip about the more that they got as part of that experience? As I remember being taught, it's really hard to convince somebody that God loves them if they're starving for something, whether that's food or whether it's opportunity or whether it's equality or whether it's dignity. The essential problem is that if we believe that real life is only and always somewhere else, and that this somewhere else is also where God is from, it completely sucks the motivation out of doing the work of being fully alive here and now, as we understand that motivation to have some connection to our spirituality or our religion. There's just this enormous disconnect that happens. And this notion of what I was taught to think of as being dead to the world can easily turn into the disconnection of our spirituality and our, at least our religion, from all of the rest of life. My maternal grandfather, who was a collection of folk sayings, like that was just, if I was going to define him somehow, that's probably how I would do it. I remember hearing him once say of a particularly pious person he knew that they had become so heavenly minded that they were no earthly good. The issue is not whether we believe in an afterlife. It's more that if we make that afterlife the central emphasis of our belief system, it can distort even the best of the possibilities of that system, at least if it's Christianity and the Christian belief system that we're talking about. Because making the afterlife the central emphasis can easily turn Christianity mostly into a system of reward and punishment. It's just a super short step. Basically, the shape that takes is that belief system can easily morph under that ideology into us and them. It gets framed as saved and unsaved, and it gives the saved this really pious project to do. But it's still a bin, it's still a sorting bin ideology. And if you take that together, what it does is it moves our focus away from our life in this world and it places it somewhere else in some yet to be experienced future. And that puts the focus of our belief system mostly on ourselves, as in, how can I make sure I'm headed to the happy place and not the overheated place? We've talked a bit in the last couple of weeks about this notion of God as love, not as loving, but as a being whose only power is perfect love. I think that this is truly one of the most beautiful Christian ideas that there is. The idea that the perfect love of God is unconditional. I really do think that is one of the most lovely legacies of the religion that I own, that's mine. That kind of love, unconditional love, I think would find any notion of restricted entry utterly foreign. Those ideas do not fit together. Unconditional and restricted entry do not fit together. I just think there is no place in unconditional love for believe this or do that or join us in order to be saved. I find those ideas incompatible. If God is love, then whatever else is true about the afterlife, it's something where God's love ultimately has full sway. And where God's love has full sway, everyone is encompassed in it. Everyone is included in it. Everyone is reconciled by it. And in that sort of a picture of God, anything to do with segregation is just antithetical to the essence of the divine. They just don't fit together. I think we can see this in the Jesus story. So Jesus is a Jew, lives in Judea, and as we have the story of Jesus in the Gospels, most of Jesus' contact and interaction was with his own people, with the Jews. But when he did interact with non-Jews, we have no record of him ever condemning them for their non-Jewishness. We have no record of him having rejected them on that basis. There never seems to be the slightest inclination to convert them to Judaism. There's never this requirement from Jesus for them to believe right things in order to be accepted. There's no club to join. There's no creed to sign off on. There's no membership classes to take. There's just this invitation to be part of what Jesus called his way. Some of you, if you grew up around Bible stories, some of you will recall the story of Zacchaeus, the fraudulent, diminutive tax collector, who invites Jesus over for drinks and conversation. And by the end of that chat, which is a remarkably short one as it's recounted in the Gospels, Zac has this complete and total and utter change of heart. And as we have the story in the Gospels, he says to Jesus, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I'll pay back four times the amount." Jesus' response to Zacchaeus' statement, I think, is rather telling. Jesus says, "Today, salvation has come to this house." Isn't that fascinating? Salvation, as Jesus talks about it in this story, has nothing to do with the afterlife for the reformed Zacchaeus. It's just not in the story. It's about here and now. It's about a new quality of life that saves Zacchaeus from the misery of greed and of selfishness, and for him, of the loneliness that came with those things. It seems to me that if I think about this whole enterprise as being about some other place and some other time, and that it means that mostly there are just a whole lot of people that are not going to just be left out but be eternally condemned, that if I'm thinking about it that way, I just might be more than a bit reluctant to live it out as though it was actually good news for everyone. I might be inclined to be sort of protectionist about it, to guard it as something exclusive, at least if I believe that I'm in the I'm going to live forever club and they're not. Heard this fantastic comedian this past week from the South, woman from the South, a pastor who's become a comedian. And she's touring, she's doing this tour right now with two other comedians, one of whom is Jewish and one of whom is Muslim. This is great, it was a CBC thing. Ray's nodding his head, we're both CBC fans, he's probably heard it too. She was hilarious. They had a little bit of her stand-up on there. And she grew up Southern Baptist. And so she's got the accent and the whole thing, right? Like, you can hear the Southern Baptist in her. And she says, "One of the things you got to love about Southern Baptists is they're concise. Like, they say things short. So, like, their idea of heaven is simple. If you're not Southern Baptist, you're not coming." And she goes on to point out how many billion people that means are not coming. Right? Like, comedians do this stuff, man. You're laughing and then wham! It's like, right. That's a problem, isn't it? I'm going to behave differently around my belief system if I think of it as an exclusive club that I'm in and they're not. And you know what? There's actually no way I can know that there is life after death. I can believe it. As it happens, I do believe it, but I can't know it. Like, there's just no way to know that. But I can know, and I know there are people who are going to take me to task on this because it's a thoughtful group of folks, and are we really living in the Matrix or aren't we? I'm going to say with some confidence, though, that I can know that there is life before death. That there is a life to be lived here and now. And I think that we can see that there is a way to live that invites us all, that invites everyone to live in a manner that is good, that is unselfish, that is compassionate, a saved life, if you will, rather than a lost life, a life lost to things like greed or indifference or self-righteousness. Like, there is actually, when Jesus talks about a way, he's actually talking about a way. Like, there's actually a way to live that is saved, not lost. I believe that eternal life, as Jesus talked about it, is a quality of life now. I think that it's a very practical, among other things, invitation to ditch things like selfishness and violence and ego-driven existence and to explore things like love and forgiveness and generosity and healing. Like, I think that the invitation that Jesus extends throughout his life is actually not the invitation to a religion. Personally, I don't believe Jesus came to start a religion. Like, we did that. Because what we saw in the life of Jesus was, what the people who were near him saw was so irresistible that they built an edifice around it. But I don't think Jesus came to do that. And I think, frankly, Jesus would be appalled at much of what happens in his name. But from where I stand, this idea that there is a quality of life that is connected to the way of Jesus that we are invited to explore and live into now, that strikes me as containing the possibility of a kind of life that I don't have to carefully guard and manage. I don't have to sort of tenuously invite people to consider that, because it's good. Why would I be reluctant about inviting somebody to explore a way of life that assails selfishness? Why would I be reluctant about inviting somebody to assail a way of life that is about growing and expanding love? Love that includes everybody. Why would I be reluctant about inviting anybody to journey with me in the exploration of what it means to dial down my ego and dial up my acceptance and my humility? Why would I guard that? I don't know. Why would I do that? Because I want to be more special? Because I want to have succeeded where someone else hasn't? Like, that's a... I'm seeing that in me. I should do some work. Because that's very unlovely. Right? But I could imagine that. Because I want to be special. I think that's a pretty normal human desire, to want to be special. Do I want to be special at the expense of others? Do I want to be at the party upstairs while they're getting tortured downstairs? To put it into kind of contemporary vision of here's heaven and here's hell. Because that's awful. I could be reluctant about inviting somebody to consider that. But to invite somebody to consider the possibility that the further we go on the way of a way like the way of Jesus, the closer we become, the more deeply engaged with we become with this thing that I use a word like love for. And the power of love, the power of perfect unconditional love, and the implications of that. I mean, the only reason I could imagine being reluctant to invite somebody into that is because I think that could be the kind of thing you might end up dying for. Like, actually. So it's a thing to take seriously, for sure. But that's different than a friend of mine, his mother is dying. And we're talking about her life the other day. Good Baptist woman, a beautiful person, like a truly lovely human being. But that I mention Baptist because when she talks about the end of her life now, and she also struggles deeply with her mental health, so that's part of the story as well, of course, but she'll say to her son, she'll say, kind of quiet, she'll say, I just hope I'm good enough. She's still wondering. God have mercy, what a system. Like, is there not something deeply wrong with that? Is it just me? Anyway, so all that to say, Judy, can I put you on the spot? Because we all have stories about that song that we grew up with. You told a great one this morning.
Okay.
At Saints Roller Rink.
Yes.
When they played this song on Christian Music Night. What happened?
Oh, everyone got up and went on.
Right.
Yeah.
And that endless chorus of, I'm going to...
And we all clapped.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And sang our heads off, you know? Like, I'm in. I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm going to live forever. Yeah. The people on the street that need something, I got something for them.
Yeah.
I got the message of how you can live forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the disconnect didn't register for us, I don't think. It didn't for me. It just felt like good news because I was in. That's the problem with that idea of life forever somewhere else. Like, it's just, anyway, I'm being redundant now. But the song was there for a reason because it's just such a concise, heedless summary of that way of looking at a life of faith. Does the idea of love going on forever have appeal to me? Oh, yeah. Does the idea of it being something that just keeps opening into more and more and more than I can ask or think or imagine, to use words from our sacred text in Christendom? Oh, yeah. Does the idea that there might be a way to live that helps me to practice that and move into that appeal to me? Do I want to do that? Do I think that's shareable? Oh, yeah. So there's all sorts of things in that idea that are, I think, good and rich and lovely. There's also a way to practice it and think about it that I think is potentially enormously problematic. And, you know, to not poke at that and wonder about it, I think can have us out on the floor at the roller rink singing along and just not thinking about it, not realizing what the other side of the story is. For me, the kind of life that can be lived with the door wide open, that's the kind of life I want to live, including my spiritual life, including my religious life. That's the kind of life that I want to have, and that's the kind of life that I want to share. So that's where I'm headed, as much as I can. Anyway, we're going to sing, because that's when we get to share things. All right.